I felt led to share from my part. You might say, well, what does the evolution of music have to do? Well, I hope as we take just a glimpse of what happened or how music evolved here in America in the last 100, 150 years, hopefully we'll renew our appreciation to have godly music and keep what we have and keep perpetuating it. I was in Arthur, Illinois for an Anabaptist financial seminar, speaking there, and it was mostly Amish that were in the audience, 450 primarily Amish, and they decided to sing a verse of Amazing Grace between the sessions, and I found out we don't all sing the same. They sang it in English, but it was different. And maybe you could just dim the auditorium lights so they can see the PowerPoint a little better here. So I'll start with the something that happened to our family. We went to Florida to the Holy Land Experience a number of years ago, and unknowns to us, one of the features that they had there was music through the years. And they started out with the monastery style music back in the 1750s, 1800s, and had a different group come in every 20 or 30 years and show how the music changed in that time. And that was very eye-opening to me. I guess I never thought how the monks would have sung years ago compared to how we would sing today. Of course, it was up to the contemporary music at that time. And with each musical genre, there was a cultural change that came with it. It was amazing to me to see how the dress and the body language and the worship style all changed with the music. It was just totally different over the years. So that was a very interesting thing that got me to thinking about the evolution of music and how we got to where we are today. The kind of music we listen to reveals our values and shapes the condition of our heart. Either we have a clean and spiritual heart and a clean and spiritual desire, or we have a dirty and carnal heart and a heart that gravitates to carnal music and maybe even dirty music, secular music. Hopefully that is not the case, but the kind of music we listen to reveals our values and shapes us. It does. Secular music commiserates with frustration and broken hearts. It does not lead us out of frustration, but makes us feel momentarily good in it. The world keeps reaching for the buttons on their radios and listening to music of experiences that they are going through, that they can feel the moment. I mean, they can commiserate with, they feel what's happening, and they like the music because of that, and it gives them some sort of artificial lift. But godly music leads us from frustration to calm and peace, to something greater than ourselves and our human experiences. That's what godly music is all about. We can be having the most difficult experiences in life, but godly music should lift our minds above those things, take our minds to God and encourage us, not just commiserate in those experiences with some other musician. Music is not stagnant energy in our life. It's not a stagnant energy in our life. It appeals to and moves our body and our mind. It is mobilizing us and putting us on a road with some ditches. Music takes us somewhere. And music has ditches on both sides of our road. It is influencing our thoughts. It is motivating our body. It demands our attention. And for me, one of the unique experiences for me was when I was just learning to hand paint and paint it with a brush. And I didn't have my own shop, and I went around to people's garages, body shops, and that kind of thing. And a lot of times they had music playing. And it was very almost frustrating at times. Depending what for music they were playing, I could hardly keep my brush steady. It wanted to move. My body wanted to move with the rhythm of the song. It does that to us. Either it is taking our thoughts to worship of the Creator, God thoughts, or it's taking us to earth thoughts and worship of the created. And that's what secular music wants to do. It wants to make us think about earthly things, not God himself, but things God created as opposed to the Creator. I said there's ditches alongside our music road, and just thinking about that a little bit, there is the ditch on the one side of professionalism. We want to be so gourmet, it has to be so perfect, or we get frustrated, we can't even listen to anything unless it's perfect. Or there can be the other side where we don't really care. It can be lackluster, and as long as we're bellowing something out, it doesn't matter if we're on tune. It's music's just not all that important. And the next generation will not really appreciate music because it's lackluster. Or entertainment. Some of us may err on the side of entertainment. It's boring until they come with some lively song with some funny lyrics, and then suddenly, oh, that was a good song. Or the other side is very little art form. As long as it rhymes, we call it a poem. It doesn't matter if it's a well-written poem or not. That's not significant. It's just a song. We don't value art form. And then there's the broad genre or the narrow genre. It doesn't, some of us maybe don't care whether it's pop or rock or whatever. It's just music. It's music we enjoy for whatever reason we enjoy it. Or maybe we can be on the narrow side of things and feel like there's only one type of music that is okay. Everything else is out. And I believe there's error on both sides of that spectrum. So our desire as Christian people is to find a middle of the road where we do value art form and we do want it to be inspiring and captivating to our thoughts and make us think deeply, more deeper than what we are, maybe as we're moving about and lift us up to God. That's what we want our music to do. All right, just looking a little bit at the history here, influences behind the music style we have today. There was a man by the name of Jonathan Edwards from the New England States. I think it was Massachusetts in the 30s and 40s, 1700s this is. The revival fire spawned a more energized, faster, and livelier style of music. He was a key figure in what has come to be called the Great Awakening. His passionate preaching did not go with slow music, so faster tempos and upbeat spiritual hymns were a part of his revival efforts. And history would say that he made a big impact. Music changed in his dispensation between the 30s and the 40s. Also, America had the slave trade happening in the South, coming from Africa to South America and to North America. And that was bringing musical influences with it. The black people were very talented, very musical people, and they were a big part of shaping our music history. Thomas A. Dorsey, he is known as the father of black gospel music. Songs written in this new style were sometimes known as Dorsey's. Christian praise with the rhythms of jazz and the blues. He faced some criticism for his music being devil's music. His subtle theology in music deviated from the standard schools of thought by referring explicitly to the self and self's relation to faith and God, rather than an individual subsumed into a group's theology. Most well-known compositions, Take My Hand, Precious Lord, and Peace in the Valley for Me. So you see what was happening there. He was bringing a new kind of music that was not out of the hymn book, so to speak. It was more of a God and I thought processes rather than a we and a groups theology, as it states there. And also notice, I only started at the 1700s, but music has always had its tug of war. I, for sake of time, I deleted some of the 1200s and 1300s indications where church groups grappled with this music being contemporary or being secular or being whatever for their time. It's always been a challenge to keep godly music on the right track. And the Dorseys were called devil's music by some. And if we listen to that today, we'd probably say, well, wow, what is ever wrong with that? At least some of it. Take my hand, precious Lord. I think a lot of us would say, yeah, we like that song. Well, then there was Mahalia Jackson. She possessed a powerful contralto voice. She was referred to as the queen of gospel music, the single most powerful black woman in the United States. She recorded about 30 albums, dozens of golds. Her occasional clapping and foot stomping had the church concerned. Jackson once said about her choice of gospel, "It gives me hope. With the blues, when you finish, you still have the blues." Now, the sad thing about Mahalia is that the sad thing she brings to the gospel music picture is that initially she refused to be a crossover, even though her husband divorced her over it. She was that popular that her husband wanted her to get into the big money and move over into secular music, but she stood her ground and did not, and he got angry and divorced her. But in the end, she broke down and did get involved in crossover gigs and did sing not only gospel till it was all said and done. Quite a sad story where her musical journey took her. But Mahalia introduced entertainment-style gospel. She gets the credit for songs like Rusty Old Halo. When I was a youth, this song was still popular. Just look at the lyrics. "I know a man as rich as a king. Still, he just won't give his neighbors a thing. His day will come, I'll make a bet. He'll get to heaven, and here's what he'll get. A rusty old halo, skinny white clouds, secondhand wings full of patches. A rusty old halo, skinny white cloud, a robe so woolly that it scratches. Some people have them, big shiny cars, swimming pools, fur coats, and diamonds in jars, real silver gates and real golden doors they'll get to heaven and trade them all for. While you're on earth, you should live like a star, brighten up the corner wherever you are, doing each day the best you can do. That way you're sure they'll never hand you a rusty old halo." And, all right, well, that was a very entertaining song. She was introducing into gospel something to make people laugh and something even sacrilegious to be a part of her gig. And that was some, at least part of the beginning of entertainment in gospel music. And we know today that that still is part of gospel music today. Elvis Presley, he was another big influencer. Elvis's musical influences were the pop and the country music of the time. The gospel music he heard, get a hold of this, in church and at the all-night gospel sings he frequently attended. Now, did you know that Elvis Presley was that gospel, that he would sing gospel songs all night? How did he die? He died of drug overdose. And the R&B, rhythm and blues, was part of his growing up as a Memphis teenager as well. In 1970s, Vegas era relied on gospel-infused high-energy vocalists known as the Sweet Inspirations. We know that Elvis Presley, those of you who know his story, realize that he had body language that was very sensual, and he could do well in Vegas, and he actually took gospel background singers along with him to be his background vocalists. And maybe I can say here that Thomas just told me on Sunday, I was not aware of that part of the story, but his background vocalists, his Elvis's music got so popular that they thought they could bring some of his style into gospel and create their own entertaining style music. And Elvis listened to their record, and after he listened to it, he broke it up. He said, if they want to entertain, they shouldn't do it with gospel, or something to that effect. He even had a sense that it doesn't belong together. All right, by the 60s and 70s, traditional and contemporary American music came to a head. Elvis and the Beatles lured America into a secular music taste. Young people rebelled and left home, scattered all over America, living in their own havens of safety from what they deemed as frigid and rigid home life and church life. And this was ahead of my time just a bit. This was pretty much going back to normal by the time I was a teenager, but I do remember this hippie movement. Their parents began to see what rock was doing, but it was basically too late. It went by storm. They moved to the West and California, and Don could probably speak more intelligently about that era than I can. But a counterculture emerged. Peace. Two fingers, peace was the sign. I remember that. A rebuttal to the unpopular Vietnam War. People rejected their comfortable middle-class lifestyles for lives of poverty and idleness. Many of these youth were middle class. They were not from poor homes, but they chose to voluntarily be poor out of rebellion and just not have jobs and be idle. They left their middle class lives to live with others who shared the same beliefs, felt the need to rebel against authority, felt a certain lack of purpose in their lives, expressed their disapproval of authority by wearing distinct clothing. They did not want to look like their parents. Chuck Smith and Calvary Chapel were a big part of this picture. Chuck was frustrated by church growth contests, and he took over as pastor of a tiny congregation in Costa Mesa, California. He despised the stinky hippies, but was moved with the help of his wife to find some way to reach them with the gospel. Smith's openness to the hippie culture sparked thousands of hippies to come to the church where he functioned as their father figure. So somehow Chuck managed to get into the hearts of these young people that were rebelling against parental authority and become sort of a father figure to them. And he hired a hippie to help him. He hired Lonnie Frisbee, who was part of the Christian street community in San Francisco. By the middle of 1968, the church was filling up with barefoot, blue jean-wearing youth and dozens of hippies and teenage runaways inhibited a string of communal homes sponsored by the Calvary a string of communal homes sponsored by the Calvary Chapel. During his tenure from 1968 to 71 as unofficial youth pastor, the church grew from 200 to several thousand members. It was amazing what did happen there in that regard. Another person, John Higgins, I don't have a picture of him, one of the co-leaders of the youth contingent, he said Calvary Chapel music was boring and admitted that despite his zeal for his newfound faith, he would sometimes come late just to avoid the music. So we see this was a group of young people that was heavily influenced by the Beatles and by Elvis Presley and that music style. And even after they were born again, they could just hardly stand Christian music. So we get the picture. Born again but bored with traditional music. Didn't want to change his music to fit tradition, so he tried to change tradition to fit his music. Youth were making up new songs all the time, and the new songs were not chained to the traditional conventions of hymnody. Members were writing gospel lyrics to things like Coca-Cola commercials and such like. This group of people was trying to figure out, so how can we be Christians now but bring our music with us? and they did it in any fashion they could think of. The peace movement rolled into a praise and worship revolution, where organ and piano, formal choirs and vocal soloists and groups once held sway over a slowly changing canon of staid hymnody and peppy gospel songs, a flood of guitars and praise choruses suddenly came rushing in during the 1970s. And Calvary Chapel movement accelerated all this. Calvary Chapel was the church that welcomed and accepted this new wave of music. And two distinct Jesus movements and a counter-religious culture evolved. The one was Jesus Rock. Jesus Rock was basically took the Elvis-style instrumentation and geared it towards evangelism and apologetics and entertainment. They turned their peace movement into a good time with the kind of music they enjoyed and tried to Christianize it, calling it Jesus Rock. And then the other was Jesus Praise, where that was a mellower brand of music aimed at corporate worship, and that is where the contemporary Christian worship movement got its roots. By June of 1968, within a few months, a distinctly new contemporary tone emerged in the churches. A big part was new songs written in the communes. For many, this brand of church music, simple, melodic, heavily reliant upon the scriptures for its lyrics, was a key attraction. So you see what was happening here. Music was boring, so some of them skipped it and didn't even come in time for that. So now they're making it into the key attraction, and of course the preaching of the word likely got pushed into the background more than it, less central than what it had been. Tommy Coombs, a down-on-his-luck hippie band member, recalled visiting the church for the first time and finding the music there utterly unique. I wasn't used to simple music like this. It blew me away. Swarms of youth were soon packing its 300-seat sanctuary for multiple Sunday services and several weeknight Bible studies. So we see they were successful at getting the youth out of the communes and off the streets. The group began to develop and attract a growing group of in-house musicians and songwriters. So these youth started writing their own songs. One was Karen Lafferty, a Southern Baptist girl from New Mexico. Convinced that she should pursue a musical ministry, she gave up a lucrative gig serenading diners at a chain of Los Angeles surf and turf restaurants. After one particularly inspiring worship session and Bible study in the fall of 1971, she went home, picked up her guitar, and applied a tune to the words of Matthew 6:33. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Alleluia, alleluia. And I think most of us could say that we enjoy that song yet today. Some very impactful music that made it into mainstream was a result of this movement. But the test of any movement is its duration. In the late 1970s, by the time I was a teenager, this Jesus movement had basically faded away. Their communes closed down, and these young people migrated back into society. The impact of their musical innovations and dressed-down lifestyle went home with them. Grassroots troubadours evolved into professional songwriters and worship leaders. So you see, they went in rebellion, and they came back wanting to change the churches back home. It was an amazing turn of events, you would say. Many churches across the continent replaced hymn books with overhead projectors. And this created, I'll call it church wars, for lack of anything better. The churches hardly knew how to handle this. The youth did not want their old church music back. The parents were glad to have their youth back, but they didn't like the music they brought back. And it ended up splitting services, having a contemporary service and then and a traditional service two separate times, which separated the young people from the old people. What happened was not a good thing for church life in the big picture. Another sad reality is in 1993, Frisbee died as a result of AIDS. At his funeral, he was best eulogized as a Samson figure. His music couldn't give him the power for holy living by changing the lyrics. Where I believe Lonnie Frisbee failed, he failed to understand that good lyrics don't overpower bad music. He thought if you have good, solid lyrics, the music style is irrelevant. He thought you can borrow the devil's tools, just use them to worship God. Come with me to church, bring your music, throw out tradition, was his mantra. Forget about dressing up to meet God, stay cool and casual, just be who you want to be, peace. He was a hippie, but he was trying to be a Christian hippie. The crisis of traditional Christianity came to a head in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And what I have here, I did not write this, and I do not remember. I had this at Youth Institute in 2014. I do not remember where the source is, but this is what it said. This era witnessed an extraordinary weakening of organized Christianity in the United States and a fundamental shift in America's spiritual ecology. They moved away from institutional religion and toward a more do-it-yourself and consumer-oriented spirituality that endures to the present day. In subsequent decades, traditional believers would hopefully cite various revivals or awakenings as evidence that their faith might be gaining the ground that it lost between 1965 and 1980. So what that is saying, that there were those moments of time when parents were hopeful that maybe there is a revival and there's awakening to what real church life should be, but they were disappointed. It says, but nothing that has happened since, whether in small prayer groups or booming mega churches, has made up for the loss that institutional Christianity sustained during America's Cultural Revolution. Music, I'll say forever, forever changed the landscape of America's churches. And yet today, the sad, sad story is the churches are closing one by one by one because music divided the generations. The young people were not willing to step into true godly music, and it's what happened. So is Christian music a victim of the arts? The arts is what drove all the catchy phrases and the type of music that the young people gravitated to and brought along back. So is Christian music a victim of the arts today? The presenting problem. The world has the edgy and the entertaining good art. Christian music is locked out, but it should be the leading edge in music. This is what some people are saying yet, some Christians are saying yet today, that the church music should be paving the way, and instead the worldly music is paving the way, and church music is falling behind. The church is asking why the world should have all the good art. This is a problem. So the solution is transition from strictly worship gospel to an entertaining gospel that borrows the world's popular trends. In other words, take the music that seems to be appealing to the world and let's harness it. Let's bring it into the church. Incorporate the desired art of secular music into Christian lyrics and everything will be okay. Well, history tells us that does not work. That did not work. Christian musicians and the arts war. I don't know how many of you know the gentleman that's pictured on there. All right, I see one hand. That man has an Amish last name, Fisher. His name is Conrad Fisher. He is a songwriter. He is one that was from Beachy Amish Mennonite background and has gained a lot of popularity in recent years. Many gospel singers and soloists begin their musical journey singing in church before transitioning to better art forms. Conrad is one who was dissatisfied with what the Beachy Amish churches had to offer by way of music. So he was an Anabaptist. He was a budding musician. He was doing little gigs at restaurants, gospel music, at a fairly young age. I forget what age he was, teenager. And one day the church asked him to sing and play for a fundraiser for a boy in their church that had some health issues. And Conrad took the opportunity at that to mix in some country songs, secular music, just a couple songs. And his story is that the bishop visited him and told him that he should not play secular music. And he was like, why? Why wouldn't you play secular music? And what for song? He couldn't even think what for songs he actually played. And one of them was Tennessee Flat Top Box. And he actually got lippy, I'll call it that, with his bishop. He said, well, why would that be a problem? And his bishop said, well, there are those that are trying to come out of that kind of music, and it's triggering to hear that kind of music played again. We would just like if you would stay away from secular music. And this is what he said. He said, I was already on my way out. I was thinking about another church in another county. I just left the church. That way, you know, the bishop didn't have to excommunicate me, and I didn't have to excommunicate him. And he went on to live in Nashville in 2018. He wanted to learn the arts, the good art of music. And he came home when COVID hit. And why am I sharing all this? I'm thinking now about Christian entertainment. So this is a young man that had some caution from his ministry about his music and how he played it. And now today he has a policy. He still claims to be a Christian, may still be a Mennonite, I'm not exactly sure on his church affiliation. But he said this, if it is some Saturday afternoon picnic in the park, I won't sign a contract that says I need to play 80% gospel music because I feel like the church wants to be entertained but does not want to be honest about it. And that is stated because there are people trying to help Conrad to not delve into the secular music so much. And they're saying, we'd like to have you come and sing for us, but can you at least keep it 80% gospel? And he's saying, no. I'm a Christian. All the music that I sing is from a Christian perspective. If you don't like it, if I have to limit it to how much is gospel on a Saturday afternoon, I'm not even going to come. I'm not even going to do it for you. Did his music get a hold of him? Did the arts get a hold of him? He says the church wants to Jesus juke everything, so they feel like it's okay to have that fun. And I want to say Conrad has a point. I feel Christian music is becoming very entertaining. And we want to be careful that that's not our motive for Christian music. Whether it's a Saturday afternoon or a Saturday evening or a Sunday morning, we're here to worship God. We're living life worshiping God. I don't think we should entertain people. This is his quote. I don't think we should entertain people with Jesus songs. If you want to have a good time, let me sing Tennessee Flat Top Box. And Conrad Fisher can tear up a song like Run Rudolph Run, like his life depends on it, claiming his life as a whole is all about Christian. It's just fun art from outside of a worship setting. It is still Christian because he's a Christian. My heart goes out to Conrad. Conrad is happy to point out the elementary poetry and literature that Mennonites and Amish send to him as bad art form. And I don't disagree. I'm sure he gets poetry sent from the Anabaptist community that isn't good art form, that they want him to put music to. And I agree that poor artist quality does not make spiritually meaningful songs simply because it is religion-juked, as he would say. We strive for excellence and creativity in our writings, including our music. But to borrow from the world's art will be a hard fit into Christian music. It's two separate kingdoms. It doesn't go together. The kind of music that Conrad really wants to play and really wants to tear into is not the kind of music that is for the Christian. It's artsy, very, very artsy, very much so. And I can understand this a little bit. I can understand his heart a bit coming from an artist's perspective. We're a bit weird and like things that other people don't like necessarily, and I appreciate all the people along the way that tried to help me rein in some of my weird art forms. But in Christian music, the world's art forms just do not fit. The world's music will have a different sound that appeals primarily to a heart that is following a different master. Even Elvis Presley was disgusted when his backups tried to make their gospel entertaining. It didn't fit, even in his mind. He knew what gospel used to be, and he knew what his music was, and he knew that there's a divide there. To give the Wee Lambs a Dr. Seuss style because it is a creative art form that has gained popularity would be a grave mistake. Why should music be different? My Bible does not tell me that a Christian's music may change to entertainment depending on the nature of the gathering. My Bible says in Colossians 3:16, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord." That to me creates a pretty broad but narrow window of the style of music that is to be coming off of the instruments that we play and out of our vocal cords. The Christian should not world juke what was meant to glorify God. Amos 6:1 says, "Woe to them that are at ease in Zion." And it describes what that ease looked like. And verse 5 says, "That chant to the sound of the viol and invent to themselves instruments of music like David." Now, I don't believe that this means, some would say, well, yeah, we're not supposed to play instruments. I don't feel that's what it means. It doesn't mean we should not play instruments. This means the instruments are meant to glorify the Creator and not ourselves. I believe this means that a mature Christian will limit his music to psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Secular lyrics are not necessary to improve a Christian's quality of life. The Word of God is quick and powerful. We are to be people of the Word. Country roads do not take a Christian home to the place where he belongs. We are sojourners here on the way to heaven where we belong. This is part of inventing music to ourselves instead of to God, I believe, when we delve into those realms. What can we learn from recent history? In conclusion, the generational blessing of music does not just happen. If we want to be sitting with our children and our grandchildren and enjoying music together, it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take some compromise. It takes give and take across the generations for generational blessing. To push out tradition for feel-good music genres has consequences. Sorry about that. We all have a native language, but can learn additional languages if we value Christian family. I think all of us would agree there's certain music styles that we like better than others. Choral music is one that's harder for me to appreciate for whatever reason. But to some of you, that is the ultimate music, and that's okay. We need to try and learn from each other and learn different languages. The zeal of youth must blend with the experience and the vision of a larger body. history teaches us that what happened can repeat itself again. Youth, if you're going to just push your music and call what the older people like, call that old fogey and whatever, and say it's boring, we're not going to be together. It's going to separate us just like it did in the past. The rigidity of old age must blend with the vibrance of youth, looking for a fresh inspiration. Youth are going to enjoy singing newer songs, and I think there's definitely a place for that. Chorus is a time to learn some new songs and maybe some harder music. And as older people, we want to be okay with that and be glad that they are trying to aspire to good music, even if it's a song we don't know. Music is only a part of worship. The preaching of the word must coincide with the length of the music. We dare not replace only music in our worship services and push preaching to the background. When secular and spiritual music share the same temple, one eventually moves out, and it's usually not the spiritual that stays. Our lifestyle tends to follow our music style. I just put this up here. The Oak Ridge Boys started out in gospel, and they ended up in secular, and you see how they changed, and even in their old age, how they appeared. And I was asked by the music committee this is not to do with history, but they wanted me to share just a little bit about music video infiltration into the gospel music venues today. And there is a broad range of music videos from the Heath Brothers, where they go all out and even do underwater photography while they're singing. Of course, it's voiceover, to the scenic mountaintop, whatever. Music videos is becoming a thing, and I like to just give some cautions from a Christian perspective. Number one, image over message. There's a temptation for Christian artists to drift toward branding, aesthetics, or celebrity culture. Visuals can overshadow lyrical depth. Should preachers start appearing and disappearing during their message? Should I pop up behind the pulpit and then go out that door and come in this door and just keep the message going would that be a good thing? Well, it takes voiceover and lip sync it's put in the spotlight on the musician and typically have multiple settings that can distract from the message of the song. The visuals end up subtly centering on the performer more than the message. And there is a difference. Live recordings simply from different camera angles are not music videos. Emotional manipulation. Music already carries emotional power. Combined with visuals, it can heighten emotion in ways that may feel spiritual, but lack doctrinal grounding. Emotion isn't wrong, but truth doesn't live off emotion. Emotion must be tethered to real-world realities. Thirdly, worldly aesthetic borrowing. Christian music videos sometimes mirror mainstream trends without discernment. Sensuality, materialism, self-exaltation, subtly shaping theology through imagery that is borrowed from the professions of the world and bringing it into Christian circles. Number four, limiting imagination and attention span. Christian music, worship music especially, should allow for time for personal reflection. A fixed visual narrative sets a moving conveyor and narrows the possibility of how an individual may internalize the song. In other words, you have to keep moving with the video. You can't really stop and ponder like you would without it. It holds the same addictive lure as screen time, especially for children. And then there's cost. And this is according to ChatGPT. A low-budget video, do-it-yourself or small shoot, costs roughly $1,000 to $5,000 for one song. A mid-range independent video, often in the $5,000 to $20,000 range. And of course, a very professional, you're looking at $20,000 plus, depending on crew, equipment, permits, travel, and post-production. And I will say, I had an Anabaptist man reach out to me. He thought my our Horse Signs would maybe like to contribute to a music video he wanted to make. It was a sizable group and a fair amount of instruments that was going to involve transporting and a lot of setup, a lot of tear down. And he was looking for about $17,000 to make one song. And he was almost annoyed with me that I wasn't willing to help him spend that kind of money to make a song to put out there for the world. Well, Jesus said, I can speak only what the Father tells me. So tonight I'd like to close with what the Word of God tells us in Colossians 3:16 and remind us again, let the Word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. Let's not lose what we have, brethren and sisters. We have something very precious. May we have it into the future, because we're all willing to pay a price to stay together in our music interests. May the Lord bless you. You can turn the lights back on.